Your workshop is about very serious experimental question of can changes of parameters over time in our universe be discovered? And that's the dumb thing to do when you carry a phone and have a microphone on. And I'm interested to learn. I haven't been able yet, but I will be going to some of the talks to learn about that. That's a much more important and serious subject than what I'm going to be talking about. What I'm going to be talking about is the notion that parameters in the laws of physics change on scales larger than our cosmological horizon, and particularly the idea that there are many universes somewhat similar to ours, that the Big Bang was, these are a collection of ideas that the Big Bang was either not a unique event or was not the beginning of the universe, and that either back in time before the Big Bang, after singularities in our universe or in other regions of space and time altogether, there are other universes somewhat like ours but with different values of the parameters of elementary particle physics. You can say right away, I mean, what a silly, you know, astounding idea, and how could such ideas possibly be part of science, where being part of science, we assume, means that has some connection to experiment, make some predictions that can be verified or falsified. And you're right to ask that question. What I want to do in this talk is do two things, is explain why there's a literature about multiverse, as it's called. I think the name comes from Martin Rees, multiverse theories. Theories, and this is very definitely, I mean, the only reason why people talk about in contemporary cosmology and physics about multiverse theories with different regions of space and time is to give an arena for changing parameters. So it is connected in that way to your workshop, and I want to explain what the motivation has been and why in the world people thought that they could improve science by positing multiverse theories. So that's the first question. And the second question is, could such outlandish ideas possibly be subject to tests? That is, could they make falsifiable predictions by which they could be proved false? Because if they can't do so, my claim is that they're not part of science. And my theme will be that there are different kinds of multiverse theories, and some of them do make a few predictions by which they could be falsified, and others of them make no predictions whatsoever and I believe should not be considered part of science. So that's the theme of the talk. Okay. And along the way, my own involvement in this has come through a series of papers, one book, another book in process with Roberto Mangibera Unger. So my involvement in this, you'll see what the motivation has been. But most of the talk, except to when we get to the end, is not so much about my own work in the subject. Okay, but it's my own point of view for sure. So why have multiverse theories been proposed? And the reason is the problem of the parameters, the values of the parameters in the present day in particle physics and cosmology. And I'm going to go quickly through this motivation because I'm going to assume that you know in this audience, in this workshop, most of these things very well because they're part of the motivation for you for thinking about parameter changing. So the standard model is great, but it has, with massive neutrinos, about 27 parameters. The standard model of cosmology is doing very well, but it has about 15 parameters. And we have no wisdom, no good idea about why those parameters have the values that they do. We don't know what sets the values of those parameters. We don't know what chooses the gauge groups in the standard model. We don't know what chooses the fermion content or the representations in the standard model. It's even worse than that because the actual parameters don't appear random. There are two issues. One of them is the hierarchy problem. If we look at dimensionless ratios, there are way too many large or small dimensionless ratios for comfort. The proton to the Planck mass, the Planck, the dimensionless cosmological constant, the ratio of the top to the electron mass, all of these are embarrassingly huge or tiny. Then there's a second issue, which is even more embarrassing, which is the special tuning problem. If you look in the parameter space of the standard model and you ask what region in the parameter space could there be a universe like ours with long-lived stars, a large number on the order of 100 of stable nuclei, a complex chemistry, the answer is a small region in the parameter space, which our present value of the parameters are within, has these features. The generic point in the parameter space of the standard model has none of those features. And that we can call the special tuning problem. And these are embarrassments because these have been noted and understood as problems since about the 1930s. And we don't know the answer to either of these generic questions or any of the many specific questions that involve. Okay. Now, unless somebody wants me to come back, I'm just going to skip through. There are many examples of this. The existence of stable nuclei involves constraints on alpha, on the proton-neutron mass difference, on alpha strong. Nuclear fission involves a relation between the electron mass, the pion mass, the proton-neutron mass difference, alpha, and those various masses. There are many changes in the parameters that destabilize most nuclei. There are additional inequalities which are satisfied in the real world for there to be stars of the kinds that we see, for there to be supernova explosions, puts constraints on the Fermi constant, the weak interaction constant, etc. Okay? So we have a lot of things that we don't understand, both the parameters in general, why so many of them seem to come in big hierarchies, and why all of those associated with low energy physics that constrain nuclear physics and chemistry seem to be specially tuned. Now, to put this in a kind of context, until recently, our business was to answer the question, what are the laws of nature? But a case can be made that the kind of question that I've been raising is, why these laws and not other laws, which is a different kind of question. Okay, we're pretty good, at least at the scales of observable phenomena. We know a lot about what are the laws of nature, that is the standard model plus general relativity. Obviously, we're very concerned to get at issues to go beyond the standard model, including changing parameters that we can get at within the Hubble scale, which is what this workshop is about. But more and more, okay, because of that success, we're focused on the question of why these laws. And the questions that I've been raising are examples. It's not enough to understand the standard model and measure all the parameters. We want to know why they have those values. And this is leading to the motivation for multiverse theories. And what I'm going to tell you is that four approaches have been proposed for why these laws, why these parameters. Two of them don't do much for us. And the other two involve, as desperate measures, multi-universe scenarios. Okay? So the logic is, and the reason why we're interested in multi-universe theories, is we have a lot of questions about the standard model and its parameters we don't understand. And as you'll see, all the approaches which are not multiverse theories have so far not answered those questions. So it's an act of desperation. And let me chart how we got there. The first approach, the one that we physicists, most of us, instinctively believe or started off believing, I certainly did, and hope it could still be true, is that the task of unification, of going from the standard model to a fully unified theory where the gauge groups were really unified and not SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, where the Higgs, and this is often not said, but the dynamics of the Higgs was in some way unified with the dynamics of the fermions in the gauge field, so there were not a lot of free parameters in the Higgs, and that all those things were unified with gravity. There has been a deep and sustained hope that this project of unification would explain the values of the parameters of the standard model, the choices of the gauge groups, and so forth, and that it would do so in a way that made unique and falsifiable predictions for experiments. This hope is not doing well. There are different approaches to unification of quantum gravity. The most studied is string theory, then loop quantum gravity, many other spin foam models, et cetera. None of them offer any hope for that conjecture. And in string theory, it's pretty dramatic, as this transparency is a sort of quick history of string theory. But in 1984, there were 5 theories in 10 dimensions. In 1985, that led to hundreds of thousands of compactifications with 3+1 large dimensions. In 1986, Andy Strominger and other people found there were a vast number of further compactifications of string theory, so-called string theories with torsion, that make beyond them no predictions. In 1995, there was the conjecture that all those different ones are unified in quote M theory. In 1998, there was the discovery of the positive vacuum energy, which is inconsistent with a supersymmetric vacuum. In 2000,
the existence of
sure, but just to trace, I mean, somehow, you know, this was known by 19. It was known in 1986 that there was a serious quote landscape issue. Okay, the path by which most people came to appreciate it was by trying to make peace with the positive vacuum energy or the cosmological constant. And that went through, and I'm just repeating this history. We can debate it over drinks later. In 2003, there was evidence for a vast number of non-supersymmetric string vacuums with positive vacuum energy. And by 2006, there's evidence for a discrete infinity of them. Okay, so, and here's a quote from the paper of 1986, where already the landscape issue is put on the table by Andy Strominger, but there was not much response till 2003. Okay, so this is a pervasive issue, and already in 1986, I'm not going to read the whole quote for you, but all predictive power seems to have been lost was clearly an issue. Okay. Loop quantum gravity raises various possibilities, which are in progress, but nowhere near as much has been or can be said about them. There are beginnings of ideas about unification. So the hope that unification would lead to uniqueness and would explain the values of the parameters is not doing well. I wish it were. Okay, but we're scientists. We have to report the situation that it's not doing well. So let's talk about the other three approaches. The next approach is called the strong anthropic principle, and it's basically the idea that God made the world. God made the world in such a way that there would be creatures who would be intelligent and conscious and would come to love him. And I'm not making this up. For example, George Ellis, who's a very distinguished South African cosmologist, very important cosmologist, makes this argument, and there are others who do. And that this God made the world in such a way that the intelligent creatures in it would come to understand that their existence was due to a very fine tuning in the laws of nature and the choice of parameters, and would therefore come rationally to know about the existence of God and his work and love him. And that's a serious argument that some people make. I see people smiling and laughing. It's not a scientific argument, but science is not the beginning and the end of everything. And some pretty distinguished cosmologists and physicists and astronomers have made this argument. But it's not a scientific argument. Okay, so we go by it. And it doesn't lead, obviously, to any experimental tests, this argument. Well, maybe not obviously, but it doesn't. OK. Well, the reason why I mentioned it is that the third hypothesis uses different words, okay, but has the same logical structure as the second hypothesis, okay, which we're just going past. The first two approaches failed. The second two approaches, and to my knowledge, there are not any more approaches on the table. The second two approaches are, frankly, multi-universe approaches. That is, they frankly attempt to look for an explanation for the values of the parameters that we see by hypothesizing the existence of a vast ensemble of universes like ours and making statistical arguments about those ensembles. And it's because of the failure of the first approach, kind of approach, and the irrelevance of the second kind of approach that so many good people have been, and smart people have been focused on this.
An opinion. If the first approach wasn't there, or wouldn't be fake, let's say, do you think that that question would be so hot?
No. If the first approach was working, then...
Let's say that we didn't even know that there may have been a possibility of explaining why we have four dimensions.
No. But it's not. You can't just do that, because the unification is not just a project of Pinter. You look through the history of 20th century physics, going back to what Einstein, Schrodinger, Pauli, all these people were doing in the 19-teens. They were all working on the same project of unification with the same hopes. Okay, so it's a long-standing hope.
Why we should care if we don't have enough experimental data? That's not a scientific problem, and the second approach is not much different from the source.
Because the fourth approach is going to make some predictions. Okay? And otherwise, you shouldn't care. And I don't know that you should care much, but you're asking the right question. Okay? And I'm going to do my best to suggest the answer to that question. But a perfectly sober and sane response to this is that it's way premature to be considering these questions go away. Okay? Now, what I've emphasized is the desperation of the situation. If you care about the origin of the values of the parameters, the explanation of the value of the parameters that has led people to multiverse theories. And second, I want to introduce the next theme, which is that there's the third and the fourth, which are both multiverse theories, the third and the fourth approaches. And there are two classes of them. And broadly speaking, the first class is static. That is, the ensemble of universes is time independent and static. And the second is dynamic. That is, the ensemble of universes evolves in a cosmological time. And I want to emphasize, and really what the rest of the talk is about, is that the first has no explanatory power and makes no falsifiable predictions, and the second does have explanatory power and does make predictions. So one has to, so they're not just multiverse theories, they're two very different kinds depending on the role of time. And you'll see how that plays out. An example of the first, these are just examples, these are classes of theories, is eternal inflation. This is obviously static, that's why it's called eternal inflation. And an example of the second is an idea called cosmological natural selection.
So why do you say eternal means static?
Because there's no, the ensemble is time independent. Now you'll see, I'm going to discuss in some detail. There just is an ensemble, it has properties that don't evolve in time. Okay, now the third, here's a formalization of the third approach, and it involves not the strong anthropic principle, but necessarily, for a reason that will become clear, the weak anthropic principle, which I'm going to define. And I'm going to be careful enough that we can critique in a precise way the claims made for these theories. So there are two parameter spaces which have to be relevant in any such theory. There's a fundamental parameter space. If you are thinking of the string landscape, you're thinking about the fundamental parameters are the parameters that tell you all the different string vacua. Okay? And there's some probability distribution on those. Then there's a map which takes those parameters into the lower energy parameters that we measure. And it's important to be careful about which parameter space you're talking about. How? It's assumed that this parameter space is known, or at least something's known about it, something's known about the map, and this, of course, is the parameter space of the standard model and standard cosmology. If you want to think by analogy to biology, this is the space of genes, the genotype, and this is the space of phenotypes. Okay? And it's interesting to study how biologists address this problem, because they have the same problem, the relationship between the fundamental genotype parameters and the phenotype parameters. Okay. One assumes that there is a vast population of universes with laws randomly chosen here, that is, a random ensemble. What random means is that that ensemble does not know anything about the hierarchy problem or the special tuning problem. So the ensemble of fundamental of choice of parameters of the fundamental theories in the ensemble of universes has not been specially tuned to yield lots of stars or lots of chemical elements. Okay, that's what random means. Okay, and it's static. There's no notion of time. You get a probability distribution here on a space of low energy parameters. Okay. Now, life cannot exist for most values of the low energy parameters. So this approach, okay, has to confront its main difficulty right now, which is that if you give a random distribution to the parameters of your fundamental theories, you're going to get random with the same meaning, that is, has not been finely tuned, a random distribution on the space of low energy parameters of the standard model. And as Rees, Carr, et cetera, have argued in detail, in almost all of the parameter space of the standard model, there are no chemical elements except hydrogen, no long-lived stars, et cetera, no supernova, et cetera. Okay. So there's a little space, tiny subspace called F, in which we can live. Okay. Since by assumption, the distribution doesn't know about fine-tuning to be here over here. It doesn't know about fine-tuning to be here over here. And because this is a tiny space compared to this, the probability distribution can be taken to be roughly constant on F. Okay. So we can't make any falsifiable predictions, because anything in F is already tied down by our existence. And any other parameter, say the mass of the top quark within some big range, the mass of the bottom quark, the mass of whatever other particles are out there, supersymmetric particles or higher generations or whatever else is out there at higher energies that don't affect the existence of chemistry and long-lived stars, will have a random distribution, and therefore there are no predictions, because any result for further experiments of parameters that don't affect our existence is as likely as any other result. Okay. How to avoid this conundrum? So this is the conundrum of multi-universe theories. You can either use the anthropic principle in its weak form and say, we live here, in which case that's fine, but almost by definition, and certainly by thinking through the way I've been thinking through, you get no further predictions. Okay? Or you have to avoid it in the construction of the ensemble. The way to avoid it in the construction of the ensemble is if the choice of parameters here is somehow finely tuned, i.e. knows about this little subspace of the standard model parameters. And that means that the probability distribution in the multiverse has to be highly non-random, and non-random in such a way that somehow what created this ensemble knows about atomic physics and nuclear physics and chemistry. Okay? That's the only option. Yes?
Is that completely accurate, or did you miss out a non-random at the end of it?
Oh, thank you. I did. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm not going to go on and edit it, but thank you very much. It's good to have careful observers. Okay. Now, there are claims for successful predictions from the anthropic principle. If the argument I've given is right, they must be fallacious. Now, I don't think I have like 12 more minutes or something like that. Well, I'll do as much of this as I like. So let me show you one. So turn that they are fallacious. There's various claims in the literature that the weak anthropic principle leads to predictions, has led to predictions even, and they're fallacious. Let me show you one example, then I'll ask you if you want more. The most famous is the argument of Hoyle. One, carbon is necessary for life to exist. Two, in fact, carbon is abundant in our universe. Three, using the laws of physics, we can deduce that for carbon to exist, there must be a resonance at a certain energy in the beryllium nuclei. Hence, we predict that resonance to exist. And the experiment was done famously by Fowler, I think, and collaborators at Caltech. And that resonance that Hoyle predicted was seen. Okay. So this is taken as the gold-plated case of a successful prediction by the anthropic principle, because the first line is that carbon is necessary for life. What's the fallacy?
I made line one.
Right. The fallacy is that the first line is irrelevant. Okay. How can you tell that it's fallacious? Supposing the resonance had not been found, we would not have questioned the existence of life. We would have looked for a mistake in the nuclear physics calculations that Hoyle and his collaborators did. Okay, therefore, the first line was unnecessary. Okay, I can go on like this, but let's just look at the same thing in a multiverse context. Okay, we just add a line zero. We live in a multi-universe with random laws distributed over a vast ensemble of universes. Carbon is necessary for life to exist. Hence, we must live in one of those universes that have carbon, et cetera, et cetera. The experiment was done. The resonance exists. But what's the fallacy is that we don't need the first two lines. Okay. And by this kind of thought, I don't want to take too much of your time. Okay, one more. Is this interesting? Okay, we live in a universe. Here's an argument about the cosmological constant. Yeah.
So I was known in that time. I'm not sure how long. So that in fact, carbon is abundant in our universe. Okay.
That's an interesting remark. Is that true?
Why? No. You know, they had the CNO cycles, right? They had the measurements of relative abundances of oxygen and carbon, and you know, if there wouldn't be a resonance in beryllium, there would be no carbon, in much less abundant carbon. Yeah.
But the question is, what were the measurements of carbon abundance on I don't know. So you're saying you
would? I was already. No.
That was all good work.
Let me go on. Yeah?
I have a comment about nuclear physics. I think beryllium is only just unstable to fall apart into two alphas. So maybe there will be some region in which beryllium is either stable or relatively long-lived with respect to disintegrating the two alphas, and then you wouldn't need any sort of resonance. That's another possibility to live in a slightly different place in which carbon is produced by different elements.
So that's an interesting point, and that doesn't help, because then the question is, if you're using the weak anthropic principle, that's another place where we could live. That's similar to Anthony Aguirre's, published an argument which is similar to that about the COVID thing. There's no reason we couldn't live in the COVID thing. Okay, here's a similar argument. I want to get on to something that does work, but here's a similar argument about the cosmological constant. We live in a multiverse with random laws distributed over a vast ensemble. Galaxies are necessary for life to exist, hence we must live in a universe that has galaxies. In fact, galaxies are abundant, so you see what's going on. Using the laws of physics, we can deduce that for galaxies to have form, the cosmological constant must be less than some critical value. Hence, we predicted it was found with less than that critical value. And again, the only thing we need is that galaxies are abundant. We don't need the fact that we live in galaxies. Now, to be fair, this is not the famous argument that Weinberg presented in 1987, which is a much better and subtler argument which still, I believe, is unsuccessful for a different reason. Weinberg's argument is we live in a multiverse with random law, so that's the same. The same two are the same. Okay, everything's the same up to the last point where he argued, since the probability distribution is random on the sub-ensemble that involves life and our universe is a typical member of that ensemble, you see how I carefully said that, then we predict that lambda is of the order of lambda zero. Because that's a different argument than the structural Hoyle's argument. And the problem with that is it depends on the ensemble, whether that's a successful argument. If the ensemble just allows lambda to vary, okay, then the probability for lambda to be with the assumptions of the argument, for the observed lambda to be of the scale that it is about 10%. Okay. But if you allow in your multiverse cosmology more parameters to vary, for example, lambda and delta rho over rho, the size of fluctuations, to both vary, okay, then the probability to be in the observed region for both lambda and delta rho over rho, I didn't say this all, goes down to a part in 10,000. Okay. So whether you think that the argument succeeded or not depends on the ensemble that you think the universe is a typical member of.
Since literally you were saying that only the life subspace, the probability distribution was constant.
Yeah, so here I'm using that. But I'm saying, okay, when you try to, Weinberg tried to argue that the cosmological constant should be of the order of the threshold for life, for galaxies to exist, okay, by using the assumption that on that space L, the parameters were random. How, whether the argument succeeds, that is, one chance in 10, or doesn't succeed, there's one chance in 10,000, depends on what ensemble you studied. Okay. And this is typical of a second kind of issue that arises with application of the orthographic principle, which is that this vagueness or slipperiness or freedom about what ensemble you're arguing in, because we don't observe any of these ensembles.
As long as the probability is not zero, you should be okay, right?
I don't think you should be. I don't think that you should. We should be proud of one part of 10,000. Anyway.
If it is zero, then there will be a severe problem.
Look. I'm going to go on. We could stop here and argue till 5 o'clock in the morning just about what I've said, but I think I've made the point, which was in red here, which is that Crane's claims that there have been successful predictions, if you want to substitute for fail, are problematic, either because the multiverse plays no role in the notion of typicality, plays no role, or the notion of typicality or random is loose enough that the predictions depend on what ensemble is assumed to be typical. But since the distribution of multi-universe is not observed, there's no independent check on what assumptions are made. Yeah, okay. So the fourth approach. So the fourth approach, which I'll say quickly in a few minutes, because this now does come to my take on the subject, is inspired by biology and is a particular way to try to realize the out that I pointed out. The out that I pointed out is if the probability distribution on the fundamental theory is highly non-random, which means it somehow knows about chemistry and nuclear and atomic physics. That is the mechanism, and what I asked myself, okay, inspired by Andy Strominger telling me often that there was this issue in the late 80s, so what I kept asking myself is there a way to evade, the weak anthropic principle, of course, was in the literature a long time already before, these are not new things. Is there a way to evade the catastrophe of the weak anthropic principle of making no predictions? The only way to evade it is to have a mechanism which produces an ensemble on the space of fundamental parameters, which somehow knows about the special things that happen to the low energy parameters when they're in the narrow ranges that give atomic physics, chemistry, nuclear physics, stars, etc. Okay, so can one posit a mechanism? Okay. And I'll show you one and show you that it leads to falsifiable predictions. After I published that, I realized that the basic theme was already in the philosophical literature. This is a quote from 1893, the great American philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, in which he basically says, it's been up there long enough for you to read it, but what he basically says is the question of why these laws will arise sooner or later, and that requires a rational explanation. Nothing in science requires a more rational explanation than why these laws, and the only way he could conceive of this happening is by a cosmological mechanism akin to natural selection, okay, which is pretty good for 1893. Okay, so to apply natural selection to a system, we have to have a space of parameters for the microscopic things, which we have, a mechanism of reproduction, a mechanism for those parameters to change slightly under reproduction, and that reproductive success depends strongly on the parameters. And that's how we're going to get in that the probability distribution on the fundamental parameters depends strongly on atomic and nuclear physics and chemistry. Okay? So as in biology and as in the weak anthropic principle, there are the two parameter spaces and a map between them. And we need a mechanism of reproduction. Okay. So the mechanism of reproduction that turns out to yield something interesting, one can play with different ideas, is an old idea due to John Wheeler and people earlier, Bryce DeWitt, which is that black hole final singularities bounce and become initial singularities of new expanding regions of space and time. And that's an old idea. There is more evidence for that in models of quantum gravity, i.e. loop quantum cosmology kinds of things, than there used to be, but it's certainly still a hypothesis. So we hypothesize that each black hole in the universe gives rise to a new universe. That's the basic hypothesis. Taking that, and that's, you can find that in Misnethor and Wheeler and papers of John Wheeler from the 60s. We need there to be variation on the fundamental landscape of theories. Okay, it's again, it's natural if you believe that the fundamental theory, like string theory, whatever it is, or could be string theory, has a large landscape of possible vacua. It's something like a spin glass has lots and lots and lots of local minima. It's plausible. There's evidence for it in string theory. But we can just make it as an independent assumption. John Wheeler also posited that. He called it reprocessing the universe. So the only thing that needed to be added to make an analogy with mathematical biology is that the variation is on the average small in scales relevant for low energy physics. So that a universe which arises from a bounce in a black hole has low energy physics, which is not very different. That is the low energy parameters that govern nuclear physics and atomic physics and chemistry don't vary very much from bounce to bounce. Okay? And that's just posited. There's no evidence for or against that. Then we need a fitness function. A fitness function, and I don't know if all of you are familiar with mathematical models of natural selection, but this is just copying what has been done in the literature from Fisher up to Stuart Kaufman and collaborators, is there's a space of parameters, and on it there's a fitness function which measures the number of progeny that somebody with those parameters has. So it's the average number of black holes created to the future of the bounce to a free universe with parameters p. And it's easy to show that that depends strongly on parameters in the neighborhood of the present low energy parameters. This is the point. If there's a problem of a divergence, one, that's a very, very good question. So it does not mean, let me back up, because I was about to give the wrong answer. It means counting the next generation, not the infinite future. So So it's a.
So do you mean cyclic universe or just the whole universe?
I don't mean particularly the cyclic universe. And the assumption is, we can discuss its justification, but all I need to assume is that black hole singularities are replaced by initial big bangs of new universes, new leading spaces. That's all I need. Just like Darwin and Mendel did not need to know the microscopic mechanisms responsible for genetics to run this argument and to get predictions from it, I don't need to know the microscopic dynamics of the Planck scale responsible for these bounces. That's a strength and not a weakness. Okay. Yeah.
So somehow the reproductivity is the possibility of forming black holes. So it's somehow
yes.
Related to the high energy physics, somehow the existence of singularity at high densities.
No, that's not true.
Okay.
The number of black holes formed is a delicate test of chemistry and nuclear and atomic physics.
So
that's the point. That's the point.
It strongly depends on the law.
And I'm going to show that to you in as much detail until I get shut up or I feel like the audience is getting bored. Okay, that's the point. Okay, the feedback which makes the probability distribution on the space of fundamental parameters know about low-energy physics, really low-energy physics, atomic physics, and molecular physics and chemistry is through the formation of stars and black holes.
So could you please explain more? Though?
I will.
In details. What do you mean by this?
What I mean by this is that let me see if it's on the next. I mean that there is a time parameter, which is the number of bounces. It's a discrete parameter.
For black hole or for universe?
They're the same. I posit that they're the same. Posit that every initial singularity of the universe is slightly the future of a final singularity of a black hole in another region of space.
Each universe is linked to a specific black hole.
A specific black hole.
Okay, so you just renamed Big Bang.
Yes.
You just renamed Big Bang, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Except I note that there are about 10 to the 18 black holes within the cosmological horizon estimated on the basis of the initial mass function, et cetera. Okay. So our universe has already about 10 to the 18 progeny. If you buy my assumptions. Therefore, by my assumptions, our universe is one of on the order of 10 to the 18 similar progeny of some previous universe. Okay? So then we apply standard arguments from population biology, which I'm not going to take you through. And standard arguments from population biology tell you that if you count time in terms of number of generations and start from a random start on a parameter space, so this is a highly peak fitness function. This is a fitness function which is, I'm going to argue now, I haven't yet, highly peaked, at least locally, in the neighborhood of the present day parameters. And if you have an ensemble evolving on a space of parameters with highly variable and peak fitness functions, and you make some generic assumptions, which if there are any biologists here, we can argue about, but I suppress. Okay. After a sufficient number of generations, the population evolves to one where the probability distribution for the fundamental parameters and also for the derived low energy parameters is peaked around local extrema of the fitness function. This implies almost no, okay, and all I need here is local. If you think you have a fundamental theory where there's some other way to finely tune it so you produce vast numbers of primordial black holes, that's fine, that's irrelevant. All that's relevant here is local, peaked around local. We're not worrying about global maxima, peaked around local maxima. Therefore, almost no local changes in the low energy parameters should lead to an increase in fitness.
Okay. So we live in the best of the world, of the
possible. At least locally. At least locally. That's all I need.
But furthermore, it implies that every black hole, well, vast majority of black holes in our local environment are universes which are more or less exactly the same as this one.
That's an assumption. Yes, that's an assumption, which some quantum theory of gravity in the future could provide support for or could provide arguments against. But this is neutral, you know, this is, and I've been trying to be careful about what are the logic of the assumptions that I need without relying on last year's publications about bouncing singularities and quantum gravity. At least last year there were some publications. In 1989, when I started playing with this, there were no reliable publications about bouncing singularities and quantum gravity. Okay. Let me take one more question, because I am likely to answer the questions, but go ahead.
Well, this is not relevant to your argument, but in galactic dynamics, you need black holes to merge with each other. Could you say anything about that?
No, could you raise that at the end? Because I have not taken that into account. And I'll say something. Please raise that again at the end, just so we can discuss it. Okay. That's a very interesting Okay, now here's the point. And the point, why does the number of black holes provide a strong probe of the low energy parameters? And the point is that a galaxy, a disk galaxy, which is producing stars massive enough to supernova and become stellar black holes. So by mass, the most massive black holes are single black holes at the center of galaxies. And we didn't know that 20 years ago. But by numbers, most black holes are neither those, nor as far as we can tell, primordial black holes, but the result of the evolution of very massive stars after supernova. That is, almost all black holes are supernova remnants by counts. And therefore, we have to ask, what is the effect of changing the parameters on the production of supernova remnants massive enough to become black holes? So there is a chain of events from the formation of a giant molecular cloud, which involves cooling by carbon monoxide, atoms vibrating in the infrared, involves shielding by ice and carbon and so forth. Okay, so that's where those elements and their chemistry plays a role. Okay. The formation of massive stars, okay, which are catalyzed or at least promoted by shock waves from supernovas from previous massive stars. So there is some positive feedback in the system by which supernovas catalyze the production of further supernovas. Massive stars are formed. There is apparently a power load. I'm saying things that the astronomers will all know, but the physicists may not know. There's at birth, a power law distribution of stars, which is a mystery. Why it's a general power law and not, say, you know, some Gaussian cutoff around the solar mass. If it were the latter, there would be very, very few supernovas and very, very few massive stars and very few black holes. But it's a power law for reasons that are fascinating, at least I'm fascinated by, but I think are unresolved, but involve a lot of messy low energy physics. The process by which massive stars evolve is better known. They become supernovas. There's a positive feedback loop through the shock waves. There, however, are negative feedback loops because the gas and the dust, which comes partly from the supernovas, okay, cool down. If there's too many supernovas, however, there'll be some negative feedback because you heat up the gas clouds that are going to become giant molecular clouds and they can't cool. So there's also some negative feedback. So it's a system which is highly damped and highly controlled by both positive and negative feedback. And those positive and negative feedbacks involves low energy physics and chemistry and even the existence of carbon and oxygen in the cooling. once one has a supernova remnant, there's an issue about whether the remnant has a mass above an upper mass limit, because there's an upper mass limit for a stable neutron star. Most of them are below the upper mass limit, and you get a neutron star. And a fraction are above the upper mass limit, and you get a black hole. So that's the engineering diagram, vastly simplified, as the astronomers will know, right, by which matter becomes black holes. Okay? Now, hence, all the parameters that have to be tuned to make these feedback processes go are implicated in the construction of the ensemble on the fundamental theories. Okay? You get tuning of the parameters as you get tuning of the Fermi constant within a range of about 3, otherwise there would be no supernovas, and then there would be no positive feedback in the system, and what's called catalyzed, I think, star formation, or there's a word for it which I'm forgetting, persistent repeated star formation catalyzed by supernovas, would not be happening. The cooling, as I said, requires carbon monoxide and therefore explains the tuning of the parameters that Hoyle was concerned with, and so forth. Efficient feedback requires separation of scales, hence you understand why there are long-lived stars.
Your preferable universe is a universe which produces maximum number of black holes.
Yes.
So this is your selection criteria.
Yes.
Maximum number of black holes.
Yes. Yes. So as far as I said, there are explanations and there are predictions. So what's explained is why is the parameters are tuned so that there's carbon and oxygen, why the parameters are tuned so there's supernovas, and why the parameters are tuned so there's long-lived stars. And this is a genuine non-circular explanation. The existence of ourself, of life, is nowhere used. The anthropic principle is nowhere used.
It does not apply to the first stars.
Very good, very good. I agree. And therefore, there's a prediction that you can weed out from them, which I don't think is one of those I discussed. But roughly speaking, it has to be that star formation got started slow. That is, if star formation is as efficient when there's no metals as when there are all these metals, then the argument that I'm making is bogus. To confirm the argument I'm making, it should be that the supernova rate, looking back, which is something that people will be able to do with the next generation space telescope, falls off with the metals in a predictable way.
I think the argument goes the other way around. If there are no metals, you don't get efficient cooling, and therefore you form more massive stars instead of low mass stars.
Right, but the question is numbers. Oh. Is numbers. We can, all of these things are things to talk about, and I'd be very happy to talk about them.
So your universe would prefer to have some strongly interacting dark matter that would form as many black holes as
we could. That's good. Let's talk about that afterwards as well. Okay, so I said there were a few predictions. I'll mention the predictions and then I'll mention and then I'll stop. The most crucial prediction is connected with the upper mass limit. An obvious question you can ask is, why don't you just dial the parameters to lower the upper mass limit of neutron stars? If you can lower the upper mass limit of neutron stars, you can, if this scenario is true, the upper mass limit of neutron stars must be as low as it can be, given the existence of the other processes, of the Fermi constant being fixed and carbon and oxygen being fixed. So let's talk about the upper mass limit. Is there a parameter that the upper mass limit of neutron stars is sensitive to that does not affect within a reasonable range the existence of carbon and oxygen and the Fermi constant? And the answer is yes, it's the strange quark mass. And some of you may know of a hypothesis of Hans Bethe and Jerry Brown and collaborators that neutron stars are K-condensate stars. The idea is that rather than there be a conversion of protons and electrons to neutrons, there's a conversion of in nuclear matter of electrons directly to K-minuses so that the cores of neutron stars are actually condensates of protons and neutrons and K-minuses. If that's true because there are two species of fermions, the equation of state is a lot softer than with the standard equation of state. And they and collaborators have argued that they cannot get an upper mass limit with such an equation of state above 1.6 solar masses. Okay. Now, that the argument that's relevant is the following. That may or may not be true. Okay. But what is pretty clear, that is, there's a critical value of the strange quark mass such that if the strange quark mass is below that critical value, that scenario is true. That is, the stable state is the Kaon condensate. Okay. What could be wrong about Brown and Beta's argument is that the strange quark mass is actually above that critical mass, and it's an old-fashioned, and neutron stars are neutron stars. Okay. So that's a prediction. Okay. If they're wrong, and the strange quark mass is above the critical mass for K condensate neutron stars, then the strange quark mass has missed an opportunity to be tuned 20%, something like that, 30% lower, such that it would lower the upper mass limit of neutron stars, such that there would be many more black holes. So I have to predict this cosmological scenario has to predict that the strange quark mass is lower than that critical value, that Brown and Beta are correct, and that all neutron stars must have less than 1.6 solar masses, okay, and that various tests of cooling of neutron stars and so forth have to be compatible with the Kaon condensate core. So all of a sudden, okay, unlike, if I can be blunt about it, you know, with the weak anthropic principle and eternal inflation, in which you're eternally talking about diagrams of things that you can't measure taking place in the infinite future and how many spontaneously formed brains there are in the future, we're talking real nuclear physics and real astronomy. Okay, all you have to do to kill this theory is find that neutron stars are not Kaon condensate stars, which means all you have to do is find a neutron star with a well-measured mass above 1.6 solar masses. So this is highly vulnerable to falsification. There's a small literature about this. I'm probably not allowed to show you this, but this is a paper. Yeah. So this is a paper which I think is either has or is about to appear by Jerry Brown. Hans Bethe, of course, unfortunately died a few years ago, and collaborators, in which they discuss the status of these hypotheses because they're now connected. Okay, and there was a particular case, so I'm not going to, again, I'm not going to read this, it's available, but there was a particular case of a dangerous observation. So all the neutron stars which are measured from binaries which have precise masses are, I'm told, below 1.45 solar masses, so consistent with this. But there are other ways of estimating from X-ray spectra off of their accretion disk. There are ways of estimating masses of neutron stars. And there were some dangerous cases a few years ago. A case PSRJ0751 plus 1807 had a mass out of that range, 2.1 plus or minus 0.2 solar masses. And this paragraph is just about how more recent analysis by the observers have lowered this to 1.26 plus or minus 0.1 something. Okay? So the hypothesis is doing well. Okay? Now, I see you standing up, so let me just say quickly two other predictions. One of them is that if inflation is right, it has to be single field, single parameter inflation. And the third actually is what I mentioned about looking at the early star formation. So I'll stop here. There are two kinds of landscape or multi-universe theories, which we who dabble in this by desperation have been forced to, the static and the time dependent. I've argued that the static kind, including eternal inflation, is incapable by construction of making any falsifiable predictions, so I don't think you should think about it or spend your time thinking about it. And this other kind, which is also a desperate long stretch, is a way to have a multi-universe theory which copies very strictly the way that biology is a predictive science, to make an ensemble of universes which is highly non-random, where the ensemble of the parameters is constructed dynamically in a way that is very sensitive to the parameters of lower energy physics, and it does lead to genuinely falsifiable predictions. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
In a coffee room. So may I suggest to transfer our discussion, I'm sure it's very interesting discussion, to coffee room. I don't suggest to stop, just transfer it to Black Hole Cafe and continue.
Okay, we'll count how many black holes there are in the black hole.
May I invite you to go to this
Black
Hole Cafe and we'll continue. I'm sure it's very interesting. Don't suggest to stop.
I thank everybody for the time, and at the very least, I hope this was, entertainment and amusement while you go back to the serious purpose of your work.